Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is On Air Daily News for Monday, January 5th, 2023. I'm Naima Latif, and today we are joining a live White House briefing. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre will be offering remarks regarding some of the current national security issues. She has just introduced the White House head of national security. We're joining them live now from the White House.
That were designed to seize the Moldovan government house and conduct an opposition meeting. These actors provoked, trained, and oversaw groups in democratic countries that conduct anti-government protests, rallies, marches, demonstrations, and the U.S. government is going to continue to support the Moldovan government and their people in their efforts to combat coercive activities that undermine democracy there.
John, good to see you. In the span of a week, we've now had two close encounters, one at sea, one in the air with the Chinese military. Are these isolated incidents, or is China becoming more aggressive?
Sadly, Ed, these are part and parcel of an increasing level of aggressiveness by the PLA, the PRC's military, and particularly in the area of the Taiwan Straits and in the South China Sea. One air intercept was over the South China Sea, and the maritime intercept you talk about was in the Straits. And sadly, this is just part, again, of a growing aggressiveness by the PRC that we're dealing with, and we're prepared to address it. You heard Secretary Austin speak to that out of the Shangri-La dialogue just this past weekend, and we're going to continue to keep the lines open with the Chinese to make it clear how unacceptable those particular intercepts are.
With that handshake at the Shangri-La conference, has there been any other conversation between U.S. and Chinese officials?
Well, I think you know we have two officials in Beijing right now. The Senior Director for China, Sarah Barron here, and Dan Crittenbrink from the State Department are in Beijing as we speak.
You have to be very careful about the words you choose, but what is, in describing this, but what is the best way to describe what China is doing in the air and on the sea?
I'll try to give you an answer, but I sure would like to hear Beijing justify what they're doing. That said, these are intercepts. Now, look, air and maritime intercepts happen all the time. Heck, we do it. The difference is when we do it, when we feel like we need to do it, it's done professionally, and it's done inside the international law, and it's done in accordance with the rules of the road. These two that you saw recently, and they have happened with more frequency than we'd like. Not all of them are unsafe and unprofessional, but these two were. You saw in the air intercept, that they forced our aircraft, an RC-135, to basically go through the jet wash. That you saw the bump in the cockpit. That showed you how close that Chinese fighter was to our jet. And in the maritime intercept in the Taiwan Straits, 150, 140, 150 yards. Speaking as an old sailor myself, I'll tell you that's pretty close when you're in open waters like that. And you could see the head of steam that Chinese vessel had on it as it crossed the bow of one of our destroyers. No call for that. It's unsafe. It's unprofessional. And as to why they're doing it, I think, again, I think that's a great question to ask them. What I would tell you from our perspective is we're flying, we're sailing, we're operating in international airspace and international waters. And both of those incidents, we're in complete compliance with international law. There was absolutely no need for the PLA to act as aggressively as they did. It won't be long before somebody gets hurt. That's the concern with these unsafe and unprofessional intercepts. They can lead to misunderstandings. They can lead to miscalculations. When you have pieces of metal that size, whether it's in the air or on the sea, and they're operating that close together, it wouldn't take much for an error in judgment or a mistake to get made, and somebody could get hurt. And that's just got to be unacceptable. It should be unacceptable to them as well.
John, you just said that this was two incidents are part of a pattern of an increasing level of aggressiveness. So why was it appropriate to send two senior officials to visit China on the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre?
couple of things. First of all, it wasn't timed to the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square. Number two, it wasn't timed specifically to deal with these intercepts. You can imagine a trip to Beijing by U.S. officials takes some time to plan. So it wasn't timed to these events. That said, both these U.S. officials used the opportunity to raise our concern over these two intercepts that I just talked to Ed about. Absolutely raised the concerns that we had. Now, we had raised those concerns to our embassy as well, so this wasn't a new message that the Chinese were hearing. But I think you can also understand, Jackie, that particularly when times are tense, particularly when there's a risk of miscalculation, and particularly when the PLA is acting as aggressively as it is with no reason whatsoever, that's the time that you want to be able to have a conversation, whether that conversation is over the phone or face-to-face. Now, this visit was very much in keeping with our larger, longer efforts to keep the lines of communication with the PRC open, and we'll see where this goes after that.
Criticism, though, of the administration for sending officials on that anniversary, was that decision a messaging misstep?
We would not call it a misstep. I mean, this was a long-planned trip, and this is the way the schedule's worked out. I think, honestly, people will be criticizing the timing of Tiananmen Square, just making a whole heck of a lot out of nothing. It wasn't time to do anything with the anniversary. And again, both these officials were nothing but candid and direct about our concerns, particularly of the intercepts. And, of course, they brought up issues of human rights as well, as we always do. It's important to have these communication vehicles open. It's important to be able to have those kinds of conversations. And I think we're a whole lot less worried about the date on the calendar than we are about what's on the agenda when we start talking to them.
Yeah, aside from expressing verbal concerns and communicating with Beijing our displeasure with this, is the United States contemplating any kind of response to back China down from this increased aggressiveness?
We have continued to convey that message to them. I mean, obviously, we're not in control of their military and their military assets or their military leaders. We urge them to make better decisions about how they operate in international airspace and sea space. Whether they acknowledge those rules of the road or not, they are the rules of the road. And for a nation like China that continuously touts international law and sovereignty and territorial integrity, you would think that they would understand when a vessel or an aircraft is operating, in fact, in international airspace and sea space. We're going to keep standing up for those rules of the road. We're going to keep standing up for that international law. And as I said earlier, we're going to keep flying. We're going to keep sailing. We're going to keep operating where international law allows us to. It's an important concept, freedom of navigation, whether it's in the air or on the sea. It's an important concept that the United States is going to continue to stand up for.
Thank you. On Ukraine, what is your understanding of whether the counteroffensive has begun?
I'm not going to be talking for the Ukrainian military. That's for them to speak to. I think you heard them say earlier today that they're conducting some offensive operations, but I won't go beyond that. That's for them to speak to. What I can speak to is how hard we work to prepare them to be ready. So whether it's starting now or starting soon or whatever they decide to step off and whatever they decide to do, the president's confident that we did everything we could over the last 6-8 months or more to make sure that they had all the equipment, the training, the capabilities to be successful.
Back to China. Do you think, though, all of these incidents are sort of an effort to intimidate or impact other channels of communication that you are trying to keep open? Or do you see them compartmentalizing the military sort of realm from you guys trying to send Blinken over there and Yellen over there in Raimondo?
It's difficult to know for sure, Jenny. I mean, obviously, when you fly and sail as aggressively, and you saw the video for yourself, I mean, you don't need me to tell you how aggressive it was. You're trying to send some kind of a message. At the very least, it's a statement of some sort of displeasure about our presence in that part of the world. But as the president said very clearly in Hiroshima, we are a Pacific power. We're not going anywhere. We've got serious commitments in that part of the world. 5 of our 7 treaty alliances are in the Indo-Pacific. The vast majority of international economic trade flows through the Indo-Pacific. We've got real needs there, and we're going to stay there, and we're going to continue to strengthen and revitalize those alliances and partnerships. So I can't speak for the PRC, wouldn't do it. But if the message that they're trying to send is that we're not welcome, or our presence needs to be diminished, or they want us to stop flying and sailing and operating in support of international law, not going to happen.
Would you say, though, as this is going on, that you're continuing to make progress in setting up these visits for Secretary Blinken, Yellen, Raimondo?
Yeah, I think the fact that we were able to get two officials there to Beijing here while we're talking is a good sign. We want to keep those lines open. It's important, especially, as I said, now. So in general, without predicting what the next visit's going to be or by whom or when, yes, we are feeling like we are making progress in terms of opening up additional lines of communication.
Thank you. Thank you, Colleen, and thank you, Dan. I have two questions. National Security Advisor Sullivan said last weekend that the United States proposed a talk with China and Russia for nuclear disarmament. As you know, North Korea has nuclear weapons, whether we agree it or not. Do you think nuclear disarmament talk with North Korea are possible to resolve the North Korean nuclear issues, or will you continue to wait for the talk with the North Korean?
It's not about waiting, Jenny. We have made it clear to Kim Jong-un and the regime in Pyongyang that we're willing to sit down without preconditions to talk about the denuclearization of the peninsula. That hasn't changed. It's not about waiting. We continue to send that message. What we haven't gotten is any indication from Pyongyang that they're willing to engage in those kinds of talks, but the offer still stands.
Yeah, let's go back to the China question. Is there some possibility of sequencing the visits differently? So Secretary Yellen has talked about sequencing being an issue, which sort of implied that perhaps Blinken should go first. But given the challenges and the sort of political and realm and in the military realm, does it make sense to foreground the economic visits first, that the economic can go first in terms of visiting?
Yeah, that's putting that cart way ahead of the horse right now. I think we're glad that we're able to get this visit in Beijing, and we'll see what they come back with. I mean, clearly one of the goals was to advance the communication with the PRC and see what we can do to get these higher-level visits in play. We're just not there yet to talk about sequencing or specific scheduling. But, look, we're hopeful, and we'll see what they come back with and what we're able to talk about.
I'm a NATO Secretary General succession thing. This is an issue. Do you know whether the President intended to speak with the Danish Prime Minister about that today, and whether he has any thoughts about the importance of having a woman lead NATO for the first time?
That is not the purpose for the trip, not the purpose for the conversation. I sort of detailed in my opening statement what they're really going to focus on.
If I can shift gears to two different topics. One is, how do you all interpret Saudi Arabia's decision to unilaterally cut oil production?
We'll let them speak for their decision to cut production. What we're going to stay focused on is making sure that there's a balance between supply and demand. You see, the price of oil was not dramatically affected by this announcement of these additional cuts, and the price of gasoline continues to come down. So the president's going to stay focused on what's best for the American people, what's best for our economy, and making sure that we're looking after those needs, and let the Saudi Arabians speak for themselves in terms of this decision to cut.
And then a separate topic, I also wanted to ask you about another visit from your foreign leaders coming up later this month, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
Yeah.
I know you all have made a very large focus on this administration on the divide between autocracies and democracies, and there have been questions about the health of India's democracy under Narendra Modi. I wanted you to articulate why have the invitation for the state dinner, and then we'll follow up. Why
India is a strong partner on very, very many levels with the United States. You saw that in Shangri-La, Secretary Austin announced some additional defense cooperation now that we're going to pursue with India. Of course, there's an awful lot of economic trade between our two countries. India is a member of the Pacific Quad and a key friend and partner with respect to Indo-Pacific security. I could go on and on and on. There's There's innumerable reasons why India certainly matters, not just bilaterally between the two of our nations, but multilaterally on very many levels. And the president's looking forward very much to having Prime Minister Modi here to talk about all those issues and to advance and deepen that partnership and that friendship.
In the following, is this administration at all concerned about the health of democracy in India?
India is a vibrant democracy. Anybody that happens to go to New Delhi can see that for themselves. And certainly, I would expect that the strength and health of democratic institutions will be part of the discussion. And look, we never shy away. And you can do that with friends. You're supposed to do that with friends. You're never shy away from expressing concerns that we might have with anyone around the world. But this visit is really about advancing what is now and what we hope will be a deeper, stronger partnership and friendship going forward.
John, with Ukraine being an important topic this week with the Prime Minister today and the UK here this week, when you consider the President's investment, the United States and allies' investment in Ukraine, does the President want to see Ukraine adhere to some of the President's wishes with respect to aggressive moves within Russia, with reports of the covert action on the part of Ukraine having an ability to act inside Russia?
Well, I can tell you, the Ukrainians have already spoken to some of these quote-unquote raids, and I know they've been denied participation in them, so I'll let them speak to that. What I can say, Kelly, and we've said this before, we don't encourage, we don't enable, and we don't support strikes or attacks inside Russia. Our effort, and we have been exceedingly plain about this with the Ukrainians, our effort is to support them in their self-defense, in defending their territory, their sovereignty. That's what's been violated here by Mr. Putin and Russia, and that's what we're helping them get back, their independence, their territorial integrity, and that's where the focus is. And I'm not telling you anything here in this briefing room that we haven't said privately to the Ukrainians in terms of expressing our concerns about that. They know our concerns. They have provided us, all the way up to President Zelensky, assurances that they will respect those concerns.
Thank you, John. I hope you can clarify one thing. On Taiwan, President Biden in Japan, during news conference, when asked about Taiwan, he said that there is a clear understanding among most of his our allies that if China were to act unilaterally, there will be a response. What did he say? What did he mean by response? Was that sanctions? What did he mean unilateral? Military intervention.
Yeah, I'm not going to go beyond what the president said. He has said that before, that we don't want to see the status quo changed unilaterally. We certainly don't want to see it changed by force. And the other thing the president said, and he said a gazillion times, is there's no reason for it to, because nothing's changed about our one China policy. We don't support independence for Taiwan. Now, we obviously do support their self-defense capabilities, and we'll continue to do that. But there's no reason for this tension in the Taiwan Strait to devolve into any kind of conflict.
Yeah. I understand that you don't want to characterize whether or not we're witnessing the beginning of this counteroffensive.
That's right, I don't.
But is this within the time frame of when Ukrainian officials told Americans that they could potentially begin the counteroffensive? Are we within that time frame?
I'm just not going to go there, Jeremy. I mean, they need to have the right and the responsibility to speak for their own military operations and how they're conducting them and where and when. And it wouldn't be appropriate for us to speak to that.
Okay. And secondly, President Zelensky told the Wall Street Journal that he needs more Patriot missile batteries and air defense to protect both the civilians in Ukrainian cities as well as frontline troops from Russian air power. Is the U.S. in the process of identifying additional Patriot batteries that they could potentially send or additional air defense? Can we see some of that?
What I would say is we've been prioritizing air defense now for many, many months. And in this last package, one I think we just talked about last week, there were additional interceptor missiles. So without getting ahead of announcements to come, I can assure you that air defense remains top on the list of the kinds of capabilities that we're going to continue to make sure Ukraine has.
Our Patriot batteries, I know that those are tough because they're fairly scarce. So is that
a possibility? They are. There's not a lot of them, either in our inventory or the inventory of nations that have purchased them. But again, I don't want to get ahead of where we are. We know air defense is a priority, and we know how well the Patriots have been performing inside Ukraine, which is, again, why we provided some additional interceptor missiles last week. All I can tell you is that we're going to prioritize it going forward. I just don't want to get ahead of announcements.
Even though
John, if I could ask you about the NORAD you sent yesterday.
Yes, sir.
If you could help us understand, there was a period of time yesterday where it wasn't clear what was going on. I think we have a sense of what happened, the tragic incident. But can you walk us through, maybe give us a TikTok of NSC involvement in this, and was there a point at which yesterday the commander-in-chief was informed that there was a wayward plane headed for Washington and might have
hit? The president was certainly briefed and informed. I don't have, like, I should have brought it with me. I don't have, like, an exact TikTok minute by minute, but I can walk you through a little bit of how it transpired in the process. Before I do that, though, I do want to express our deepest condolences to the family members, the loved ones of those who died in that crash. Just terrible, terrible news. Nobody wants to get that, and we need to keep them front and center as we talk about this. But this is part of, you might remember after 9/11, Operation Noble Eagle was stood up, and it's an organized operational way of policing airspace, particularly sensitive airspace over the United States in the wake of 9/11. There are Noble Eagle-like incidents that happen from time to time where private aircraft wander into secure airspace and we have to notify them to leave. And 99 times out of 100, that's all it takes is a quick call on the radio, hey, you're getting into some airspace you don't need to be in, and usually that takes care of it. But under this process, if a pilot is non-responsive to those requests and continues on course and speed and altitude to enter restricted airspace, then there are, under NORAD's authorities, there are the responsibilities to put aircraft up to again, send the message and get a different outcome. And that's what happened here. Six F-16s from three different air bases on the East Coast. Certainly, Joint Base Andrews was one of those three launched into the air. Six F-16s, three air bases launched to intercept this particular Cessna citation. As I understand it, the two from Andrews were the first ones to reach the Cessna, and they had to turn on the speed to get to them, which is why people here in the district area heard a sonic boom. They had to break the sound barrier to get up the speed to get to the aircraft in question. When they did, they did exactly what they were supposed to do: try to get on the radio, communicate to the pilot. That wasn't working. Made themselves visible. That didn't work. And tragically, it ended obviously in the crash and the death of all on board. But throughout that process, there's a conference call that's set up when you have a Noble Eagle incident where NORAD's on the phone, DOD's on the phone, NSC was on the phone in real time, monitoring it and getting real time updates from the pilots. In this case, these two F-16 pilots, and so that everybody's in the loop, literally in real time, and that's what happened yesterday. And again, at the appropriate time, the president was briefed and kept informed.
Was he informed while he was at JBA, or was it?
I honestly don't know the exact moment at which the president was informed, but he was briefed on the incident.
Great, thank you, John. I wanted to ask you, going back to the China question. And the various episodes which have occurred over the course of the past 2 weeks involving China's military and our military, at what point does the president pick up the phone, reach out directly with President Xi, and say, enough, we can't continue these episodes for all the reasons that you talked about earlier? At what point does the president himself get involved in this?
We have sent that message directly to the PRC, as I said earlier, through various vehicles, including the conversations that these two officials, one from the NSC and one from the State Department, are having in Beijing as we speak. The president will have another conversation with President Xi, and he'll do that at the appropriate time. And I'm sure that when he does, he'll be just as candid with President Xi then as he had been in the past in terms of our concerns, the challenges in this bilateral relationship, but also about the opportunities that still remain and we want to continue to pursue.
Thank you. Just a follow-up question on China. We're getting mixed messages from China that while
Secretary of Defense Austin is not being able to meet his counterpart in Singapore, and yet the Credit Link Assistant Secretary is visiting China. So my question is, do you think it's more difficult to establish a communication channel, military communication, rather than diplomatic?
Yeah, that has proven more difficult, sure. I mean, go back in time to when then Speaker Pelosi visited Taiwan. The Chinese, in retribution for that, shut down some lines of communication, and one of them was the mill-to-mill line. And that's still not open. In fact, that's one of the reasons why we want to get Secretary Blinken back over to Beijing, because that was part of his task, was to see if he can't open up some of those lines. Now, it shouldn't take the Secretary of State to fly to Beijing to do that, but I know he's willing to if needed. Secretary Austin has, for his own part, tried to get those military-to-military lines back open for himself, and we have been unsuccessful, and that's unfortunate, particularly because of why we spent the first 10 minutes in this press conference talking about these two dangerous, unsafe, unprofessional intercepts. It's exactly because of that you want to be able to have open lines of communication in the military channel. So yes, it has been more difficult, and we hope that can change.
Yes.
Could you give us a little more preview on Rishi Sunak's visit? And apparently he is also pressing for his candidate for NATO Secretary General. So apparently he's actually going to bring it up. So what do you have to say about that? Ben, does that sound good to you?
I'll let Prime Minister Sunak speak to what he intends to raise with the President. The President's very much looking forward to this visit as well. I mean, obviously, the United Kingdom is a strong, strong ally and a terrific friend on so many fronts. I have absolutely zero doubt that the war in Ukraine will be a prime issue of discussion, and the Brits have been right there, literally at the fore in terms of helping Ukraine for the last 15 months, and I have no doubt that they'll talk about ways in which we can work together going forward for the future. I just don't have anything on the next NATO SecGen to speak to. The President hasn't made a decision about who the United States would support, and I certainly don't want to get out ahead of him on that. I will say, while I've got the chance, that the President remains very grateful and appreciative of the leadership of Jens Stoltenberg as Secretary General. Has been extended, two or three times, I think, and he's just done a masterful job, particularly when you look at what the alliance has been able to do unilaterally, sometimes bilaterally, in terms of supporting Ukraine. So an awful lot of NATO business to be done, and I'm sure that they'll discuss a whole range of those issues, but I don't want to get ahead of that discussion.
Was there any effort yesterday to evacuate the White House or the Vice President's residence of this plane off the airspace? And if not, why not?
I'm going to let the Secret Service talk about security here at the White House. That's not something for me to tackle.
Any review now of how this was handled, if the response was appropriate, considering the risk?
I refer you to DOD to talk to whatever after action they might do. It's not uncommon after any operation for the military to take a look at the and how it performed. Having observed this myself for many years, what I saw was just a classic textbook response to, in this case, what was an unresponsive pilot, an aircraft, again, with a completely tragic outcome.
Thank you so much, John. On Iran, Iran is reopening its embassy in Saudi Arabia after a seven-year break. And it was a Chinese broker deal. I just wanted to get the U.S.'s assessment on what this could mean with the health and security situation in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz. Will the U.S. decrease its maritime presence in that area? And how could this affect the Abraham Accords?
Which one of those seven do you want me to take first?
All of them.
Look, let the Iranians and the Saudis speak more specifically to this. What I would say is, just in general, is we support more integration, more dialogue, and more transparency throughout the region. And if the Iranians open up an embassy in Riyadh, can help increase transparency of what they're doing and why, if it can de-escalate tensions, if it can lead to a reduction in their destabilizing behavior, including intercepting maritime shipping as they attempted to do over the last several days in the Strait of Hormuz, then all that's to the positive.
Karen. Thanks. follow up on Jeremy's question, in that Wall Street Journal interview, Zelensky also said that Russia's dominance of the skies over the battle zone will mean many Ukrainian soldiers will die in the counteroffensive. Does the White House agree with that assessment that he gave?
I certainly wouldn't think that it would be appropriate for us to lend veracity to estimates by the Ukrainian military. Casualties they might take. That's really for them to speak to. Again, bear with me because I know this is going to sound like I've said this a gazillion times, but we have done everything we can to make them ready. And that's not just about weapon systems. It's about training and how to use it. And more critically, it's about how to integrate those capabilities on the battlefield in what we call combined arms maneuver, which is what they believe they're going to need to execute to be able to conduct successful counteroffensive ground operations. And we have really done a lot to help get them ready for that. But as to how many casualties they might take, I think that's really certainly nothing we would speculate on. And in war, those things are unpredictable. And it's a lot of it's going to depend on how and where they conduct these operations and what kind of resistance they face from Russian forces.
Could you give your assessment, the administration's assessment, on how significant the recent and ongoing gains are by Ukraine around the city of Bakhmut?
I would just tell you that again, I don't want to armchair this thing, you know, day by day. There has been continued vicious fighting in the Donbas area. Certainly, Bakhmut did not see much of a reprise of the violence. The Ukrainians have been fighting bravely for Bakhmut, even as they withdrew forces. They still stayed in the vicinity of Bakhmut. I'll let them speak to the reasons why that's important and why they're conducting those operations the way that they are. Again, our focus is on just making sure that they're ready.
Thank you. There was a Microsoft Outlook outage this morning. Is the NSC monitoring any reports of foul play involved? I asked last week about Mauritius. I wonder if you had a chance to read up on it.
I mean, you know what? It was the second today where I'm thinking, I wonder if I should make myself ready on Mauritius. And then I thought, nah, there's like no way that question's going to come up again. So I do not have an answer for you, brother. I'm sorry. I'll have to get back to you.
Thank you. On Saudi Arabia, again, on the decision to cut production, was that any advance notice given to the administration on sort of what their thinking was on that? And I guess more broadly, what you can share as to how it plays into this sort of ongoing review of the U.S.-Saudi relationship?
I know no advance notice, nor would there need to be. I mean, that's not that was a unilateral decision by a sovereign state, so I'll let them speak to that. And we've talked about this relationship before. I mean, as I said, I think a few weeks ago, there's going to be issues where we don't agree with Saudi Arabia, and we have the kind of relationship that we can express those concerns directly, and we do all the time. But we're focused on the future. Saudi Arabia is still a strategic partner, has been for 8 decades, will be for the next 8 decades, and we're managing that relationship going forward. That's what our focus is on.
Thank you very much, Karine, as always. Admiral, thank you. I want to ask one question about Ukraine's strategy and one question about the series of national security leaks that were first detected in early April, if I may. On Ukraine, I wonder if you could explain a little more why it is that the United States urges Ukraine against the conduct of cross-border operations. Wouldn't it be the swiftest way to bring this war to a conclusion if Russia were made to feel even a fraction of the kind of pain that it has inflicted on Ukrainian territory?
We have been pretty consistent about this, James. We don't. We've been consistent about the rationale too. I think we can all agree, no matter where you stand on the war in Ukraine, that having it escalate to be exactly what Putin has claimed it to be from the beginning, a fight against the West versus Russia, or the United States versus Russia, or NATO versus Russia, is not good for anybody. It's certainly not good for the Ukrainian people. It's not good for our European allies and partners. It's not good for the Russian people. So we don't want to see this war escalate beyond the degree that it's escalated before, and that's been our justification since the very beginning.
On the national security leaks, I wonder if you have today any better sense of how damaging to national security they were. I ask this because I was struck by the divergence, if you will, in your comments and those from President Biden on the subject. You came to this room and you pleaded with all of us not to publish this material, even if you came into possession of it, presumably because of the damage it would cause. And in fact, even in court filings, in the ongoing prosecution, federal prosecutors are referring to the great damage caused and the potential for greater damage. And yet we saw President Biden say that there was nothing of great consequence in these leaks. How could that be true? Oh, they're true.
First of all, when we made those comments, it was at the very beginning of these disclosures. We didn't know the full scope of what was out there. We didn't know what hadn't been made public yet. And the classification on a lot of this intelligence gave us proper pause for concern. And I still would make the same point I made before. We would urge you not to publish this material. We don't think that this material belongs in the public domain. That said, the more we have come to learn over time, and this is what the president was referring to, is that much of the information that's out there, and I say this with the caveat, James, that I still don't think we know for sure that there isn't more coming. But what we've seen thus far, now weeks afterward, it's a snapshot in time, a very distinct period of time, 6-8 weeks worth, and certainly events and follow-on intelligence assessments have simply moved on from where those assessments were, or those ones that were published. The other thing I'd say is that many of them were based on unfinished intelligence. It's no different than, in many ways, the way you guys do your job. When you get a source that tells you something, you do the right thing and you follow it up and you check it with two or three other sources until you triangulate yourselves and get where you're comfortable with what you've got, right? Well, a lot of that information was based on early reporting that had not been corroborated.
And that was the White House press briefing today. Admiral John Kirby offering more insight on the White House's position on how to prevent the escalation of war between Russia and Ukraine. I'm Naima Latif. This is On Air Daily News for Monday, January 5th, 2023. Join us again tomorrow. We'll be live 1 p.m. Central, 2 p.m. Eastern. Until that time, enjoy the rest of your day.